Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and this is number 0539, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0539. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, travel writer Rick Antonsen, author of Walking with the Ghosts in Papua New Guinea. What does the title signify?
As we journeyed on what is called the Kokoda Trail, we're actually on a 60-mile trek that is quite severe, quite demanding, lots of ups, lots of downs, slippery, and so it is challenging. But emotionally, it's draining because this is where the Australians and the Japanese fought a brutal battle, which General MacArthur called the worst fighting conditions in World War II.
Richard Louv, author of Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs.
If we're aware, if we pay attention, not only to our pets, but to wild animals, they can reduce our stress, they can particularly make us feel more alive, and they can make us aware of a conversation, essentially, that's going on all around us. And by doing that, we can reduce our loneliness. There's an epidemic of human loneliness going on that medical folks are now saying is more of a cause for disease and early death than obesity.
Teen actor Marcus Zane. Marcus actually enjoys the dreaded audition process in acting.
Obviously, there's some instances where there's some disappointment, but I kind of see it as just an opportunity to get better. And at the end of the day, I really enjoy acting, so even auditioning is a fun thing for me. So if I don't get the role at the end of the day, it was still fun for me.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0539, was Keith Perron, host of Happy Station Show, which he does from his home base in Taipei. And it sounds like he just did the opening slate in traffic. He also runs PCJ Radio International, one of the homes of the Stuff File program, and we used to work together back in the day at Radio Canada International. Thank you very much, Keith, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. A show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Actually, first up on the program, I want to talk about the recent British election that brought Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party a majority victory. I have the BBC News Channel, and I found myself riveted to the TV for the entire night of the election. It wasn't for the drama that was unfolding, because exit polls early in the night predicted that the Conservatives would win big. It was the announcements of the actual riding wins that were memorable. For those who have never watched a British election unfold, the returning officer of each riding walks up to a podium with all the riding candidates standing behind them, and they read out the vote count in alphabetical order of the candidates running. Now, in the UK, there are several fringe parties and also several of what's known as frivolous or joke parties. They, too, are on the ballot and are standing on stage with the other candidates in front of large crowds waiting for the announcement. So it's rather a surreal moment when you hear about candidates who are listed on the ballot as Lord Buckethead and Count Binface. Surreal because the returning officer reads all of the names off with all the gravitas that they've earned, and the joke candidates are usually in full costume. Here's the announcement as heard on the BBC from Uxbridge, which is Boris Johnson's riding.
We're going straight to Uxbridge, where the Prime Minister's seat is, and let's join the returning officer.
Is as follows. Harvey Jonathan David, commonly known as Count Binface, independent, 69. Hughes, David, Stephen, commonly known as Lord Buckethead, the official Monster Raving Loony Party, 125. Burke, Norma, Independent, 22. Courtney, Jeffrey Dennis, UK Independence Party, 283. Humphreys, Joanne, Ilone, Liberal Democrats to Stop Brexit, 3,026. Johnson, Alexander Boris de Pfeffel, commonly known as Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party candidate, 25,000. Keir, Mark Allen, Green Party, 1,090. Milani, Ali Reza, Labour Party, 18,141. Smith, Robert Jr., commonly known as Bobby Elmo Smith, 8. Tobin, William John, 5. Utting, Alfie John, Independent, 44. Jorgenstein, Yais, commonly known as Yais Interplanetary Time Lord Jorgenstein, 23. The number of rejected ballot papers was 93, and I hereby declare that the said Boris Johnson is duly
Boris
elected.
Johnson, Prime Minister, re-elected in Uxbridge.
There were 12 candidates running in this riding, but don't you feel kind of sorry for the poor independent candidate who came in behind Count Binface, Lord Buckethead, the number of spoiled ballots, and just ahead of Elmo and Yais Interplanetary Time Lord Jorgenstein? Even Boris Johnson, in his acceptance speech, thanked his more colourful opponents.
It is an absolute privilege to do this job and to work for you. And I thank, once again, the police, the council, everybody who's worked so hard all night to count for us, the returning officers. I thank my fellow candidates in all their glory, Lord Buckethead, and others, Elmo and others. Forgive me if I don't identify them all.
And this all took place at 4 a.m. London time. See what I mean? Never a dull moment in British elections. Anyway, still in the UK, a sex-mad duck named Dave had a surgery to remove his penis because of his over-enthusiastic mating. Poor Dave lives with three females, Dora, Frida, and Edith. His 39-year-old owner, Josh Watson, noticed that Dave's love muscle was infected in October, and he took him to a local vet who gave antibiotics, painkillers, and a daily wash for the traumatized member. But despite the medicines, the problem got worse. Dave the Drake refused to curtail his duties and heroically kept on paying way too much attention to his female friends, 10 times a day or more, with each of the three, until the tip of his penis turned black and began to die off. In the end, Dave had to undergo surgery at a specialist veterinary hospital in Bristol. Highcroft Rabbit, Small Mammal, and Exotic Vets explained, "A duck's penis is only used for mating, not urination. So Dave underwent surgery to remove his penis." While Dave won't be able to breed anymore, the surgery won't have too much impact on the animal's future, said the vet. "He'll definitely still try to mate. It's not going to stop him." Well, was this procedure a costly one? In other words, did they just put it on Dave's bill? Nah, he probably had insurance.
Affleck!
And finally, Operation Santa's Naughty List took place December 3rd to the 8th in Polk County, Florida, seeking to target human trafficking and prostitution, and it was beyond successful. The sting stung 124 people, including 46 customers and numerous others, for different crimes. But the standout was Rodney Davis, a 56-year-old husband and security guard at Disney World. When Davis showed up to purchase sex from an undercover detective, he was wearing nothing, not even socks. Prostitutes who were identified as victims of human trafficking were taken to shelters and offered support services. You know, I'm guessing that in the past, Rodney must have gone to sex workers who charge by the hour, and he didn't want to waste time disrobing. And by the way, as a security guard at Disney World, he must get sick and tired of hearing It's a small world after all.
It's a small world after all. It's a small world after all. It's a small world after all. It's a small, small world.
Actually, he'd probably hate it even more if he heard the prostitute singing that. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Travel writer Rick Antonsen returns to the show. We've had him on a couple of times when he was promoting several of his books, including the travel memoirs Route 66 Still Kicks, To Timbuktu for a Haircut, and Full Moon Over Noah's Ark, An Odyssey to Mount Ararat and Beyond. His latest book is Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea. Rick joins us via Skype from Vancouver to talk about his latest title. Hi, Rick.
Thank you for having me on, and hi to you.
Thanks for being on the program. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
It means a lot to me.
Since you are a travel writer, and you've been doing this for a while, and as I've just mentioned, you have several books out, I'm just wondering, has the knowledge of the fact that you're writing a book or going to be writing a book, has that altered or changed in any way the experiences you have when you travel?
You know, that's a really curious question, and I've not been asked that, but I think you hit on something that I have to ponder, because first of all, when I wrote my Timbuktu book, it had to be patched together from pretty sketchy notes, and I didn't date my notes properly. I'm not a journal keeper, so it was a lot of extra work when I found out there was a book in it. I think progressively I've improved and matured. So, for example, with Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea, I kept better notes. So that made me more attentive. I probably paid more attention to snippets of conversation and looked into the eyes of the porters we were with and elements like that, thinking that, gee, there really could be a book in this. So I think you've hit on something. It has changed the way I travel because I'm more attentive to the possibility of writing about it.
How many years have you been doing this?
Well, it was decades ago that myself and my older brother and a friend of ours named Mary Trainer cooperated on a book about a lost gold mine on Pitt Lake in British Columbia. And it's one of Canada's best known lost mine legends. We updated that in 2007, but really the act of travel writing has been the last 10 years or so in terms of the books. And at the time I was president and CEO with Tourism Vancouver, and that job was extremely demanding. So 5 years ago, I left there with the intention of focusing on a new career to be a full-time book author.
I ask the question only because you have been traveling for so long, but travel through the years has changed. I guess the biggest change would be post 9/11 for one thing. And I'm just wondering, for someone who travels as much as you do, how has the daily rigors of traveling, not just the destinations you go to, but the daily rigors of traveling, how has that changed for you, either harder or easier over the years?
Well, you hit on two things, because sadly, though I got to Timbuktu, we'd all be kidnapped bait if I were to journey there today. So that's dangerous. The Mount Ararat trip would not be allowed today by the military because of conflict in the region. So there's that aspect, which is about the world sort of constantly on the brink of something bad. The other element of what you ask is, it's become a chore to travel, even if one is getting on a plane between, you know, Vancouver and Montreal or New York and Chicago. It's just now a lot of work, which dilutes the excitement of it and certainly sort of impedes that sense of freedom and adventure.
Let's talk about your latest book, Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea, and let's start right off with the title. Explain the title to us.
As we journeyed on what is called the Kokoda Trail, or sometimes called the Kokoda Track, we're actually on a 60-mile trek that is quite severe, quite demanding, lots of ups, lots of downs, slippery, and so it is challenging. But emotionally, it's draining, because this is where the Australians and the Japanese fought a brutal battle, which General MacArthur called the worst fighting conditions in World War II. And it was 6 months, mostly towards the end of 1942, for Americans and Canadians and Europeans. This was war at the end of the world. Of course, for Australians, it was war on their doorstep. So it is filled with meaningful history of that war, in as much as the battle sites are kind of protected. They're not manicured or modernized as they have been, say, in places in Europe, where there are places people make a pilgrimage to. These sites are as overgrown with 17 shades of green and jungle, and there are narrow trails, and you've got precipices. All of that is as it was in 1942. So you're really on a trek through history.
When you go to places like this, first of all, had you been there before, or is this the first time?
This was my first time there, and my wife, who was general manager with the Cairns Airport in northern Queensland at the time, she'd been to Port Moresby a couple of times on business, but that was my only encounter with the country.
When you travel to a place like this, especially with the knowledge that you're going to be writing about it, is one of the types of things that, in this particular instance, surprise you the most? Because I'm sure you do a lot of preparation and you have a pretty good idea of what you're getting into when you go somewhere. But what were some of the surprises when you got there?
Well, to your point about the preparation, one needs to go with an organized guide, because that's you're going through indigenous territories. There are different sort of chiefs or tribal property ownerships. They have to be compensated in some way. You need the element of safety. There are Papuan porters that one retains in part for safety and in part to help carry your goods because of the demands of the trek. I was, as I have been elsewhere, surprised at the wonder of the people and how we're kind of the same all over the world, but the differences that show through, for example, with the Papuans, they sang in the morning. They were up before we were. We were up at 5, but they were up getting breakfast ready, and they went to sleep after we did at night, when we kind of collapsed because we were drained, and they would be singing. And along the trail, there was a guitar player, one of the porters, and they sang all the time. I hadn't expected that, nor was I aware of how wonderful their voices were. There were a people when we saw in villages, the young children, full of smiles and full of welcoming. So that was all a really, really nice surprise, as you are dealing with the emotion of the drama from 1942 that occurred right there.
Besides the history of the war, what are some of the misconceptions that the general population might have about the area you went to?
Well, Papua New Guinea still suffers under the weight of quite a dated perception about headhunting and a totally out of sync image about cannibalism. Those are words that pop up quite quickly in general conversations when you're talking about going there. So that's disappointing. I've tried to write about those issues, about each of them, and explain what they are and how they're a ritual and how they're part of almost a not a religious practice, but they have a moral equivalency to going to church or to some of the things that Westerners are more accustomed to. And yet that image stays there. The country of Papua New Guinea is on the island of New Guinea. It's the eastern half of it. But quite often people think of the entire island just north of Australia as actually being Papua New Guinea. So there is that misconception. The other is that while it's a thought of as a country with dangers because of the rascals, RASKOLS, that have some sort of tribal grievances that have been carried into the main townships now. And that's alarming to a lot of people. But yet there are beautiful dive sites. I'm not a diver, I didn't get to them, but apparently they are the best in the world. There are portions where you can go and visit remote villages, and those are experiences that are incredible. And so Papua New Guinea deserves to be experienced by a much wider range of travelers than it currently does.
Well, speaking of travelers, is there much tourism there?
There's a modest amount, a lot of it from Australia, because it's distant, so distant from say Europe or Canada. It doesn't get as many as it could, but it is an affordable and organization-wise quite workable addition if someone is traveling, say, to Australia or elsewhere in the South Pacific. What they don't get is a lot of repeat travel, which, say, a destination like a Montreal or a Florida or a Paris would get people going back several times. Usually, Papua New Guinea is a one-off visit for most of the people that are there.
I was about to ask, is it one of the places, because it's so distant from the rest of the world, is it one of the places that's overlooked? Because when people head in that direction, they're usually going to Australia or New Zealand?
You know, you hit it exactly right. It's a long way to get to, and if someone has set aside 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, you could fill that just in Australia, you could fill that just in New Zealand and still have lots left over. But, you know, it's part of the expense, part of the time of getting into that region that makes people limit theirs. And this is a logical add-on, but there are so many other beautiful places in the South Pacific that people may add on first. It does deserve its own couple of weeks. We went to a place called the Northern Beaches when we came off the Kokoda Trail, and they are stunning. They only get maybe 200 visitors a year, we were told, and yet the villages are trying to accommodate more people, have proper facilities, and when you're in one of those villages, they do everything they can to share their food, share their hospitality, share their music, and make you feel like you're the most welcome person on the planet.
Well, how modern is life there?
Well, along the trail, you don't see many signs of what we would be accustomed to in Australia or in Canada. You just don't encounter that. When you're in the sort of the northern beach area, you know, of course, there are automobiles, but not a lot of them because they don't need them in the villages. It's a more of a boating and fishing setup, not a lot of agriculture, though they're maybe harvesting coconuts or pineapple and so forth. Not a lot for export. You know, Papua New Guinea was, over the thousands of years, populated by people who would live in mountain valleys or distant villages or locations along, say, the seashore. They didn't have a lot of interconnection. And in fact, there are 6,500 living languages around the globe. 832 of them exist in Papua New Guinea. It only has 0.1% of the population. The only other country with that many living languages is India, which by comparison totally makes sense that it would have something like that. But here it is with all these individual languages, because they weren't trading, they didn't have to bother to fight, and they didn't need anybody other than their own villagers.
Fascinating indeed. The book is called Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea. And I know this is your latest book. I also know you're working on another one, which will come out next year. Will you come back when the new one comes out as well?
I'd love to come back when the new one comes out. It'll be out next September, and it's about travels with my grandson around the Rocky Mountaineer train in Western Canada. It's just, as my other books, loaded with biography and history and really surprising encounters that I've been the benefit of as a traveler, as so many people are as travelers.
Well, Rick, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
I thank you for having me, and I particularly like the questions that you come up with, because as I remember from other interviews, your questions surprise me and get me thinking about new ways about my writing. Thank you for that.
Rick Antonsen, author of Walking with Ghosts in Papua New Guinea. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0539, and you'll find links to Rick's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Our Wild Calling. Plus, we'll meet teenage actor Marcus Zane. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including Stitcher and TuneIn, and also heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. Mont Hardcastle is the manager of a bar and grill at the Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri. Now, one night, while at his establishment, he said, "I told my bartender to call the police. Let them know that I'm going to be over there holding this guy for them." The guy he was referring to was a man he spotted in front of the store across the street, a lingerie boutique. The man was yelling and screaming and banging on the windows, Hardcastle says, and it was the last straw when the man kicked in the store's window. Hardcastle ran over, grabbed the man before he could climb into the store, pulled him to the ground, and sat on him to wait for police. At least the man explained to his captor what he was doing. He was trying to rescue the lingerie-clad mannequins. He said that the mannequins were telling him that they needed to be let out. Hardcastle decided to get involved because, quote, "It's somebody's business. I'm not the type of person to stand idly by and watch something bad happen," unquote. As for the alleged perpetrator, you know, there is a centuries-long tradition of aiding damsels in distress, but I don't think that lingerie-clad mannequins quite fits the bill. Yeah. A subway worker in New Mexico robbed her own store and said it was to teach a fellow employee a lesson. The robbery took place at about 7 p.m. Police said employees told them a man and woman robbed the store but fled before officers arrived. At the time, two employees were standing inside the store, and a customer was at the drive-thru window when power to the business went off. That's when a masked woman entered the store, jumped the counter, and verbally and physically threatened the two employees. The woman also ordered one of the employees to get rid of the customer at the drive-thru window. While the suspects took both employees to the back of the store, a customer escaped by running to her vehicle. One of the employees said they recognized the voice of 22-year-old Lorena Marin, a co-worker. Now, while investigating the robbery, an officer was flagged down by someone who saw a white Kia Optima parked suspiciously in the area. Officers located and stopped a white Kia Optima, and inside, police found Marin and 19-year-old Angelo Ray Espinoza in the car. Marin allegedly told police she was involved in the robbery and indicated she wanted to teach one of the employees a lesson about what could happen late at night in that part of town. Both were booked on one count of robbery each. Well, Lorena, you no longer have to worry about working in that part of town, do you? Yeah. Two men are facing criminal mischief charges after police say they climbed a Christmas tree in Largo Central Park in Florida. Police say Alex Lackey and Shay Tracy climbed the city's 35-foot Christmas tree to willfully and maliciously damage it. Two other people saw Lackey and Tracy dangling from the tree and throwing ornaments to the ground. According to the arrest report, one of the witnesses was a city employee. Lackey and Tracy caused $250 in damages. I guess they thought they were cats. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Turlock, California, mothers became alarmed when a man turned up at their doors asking for 5 strands of hair and fingerprints of their children in order to collect their DNA. Said one mother, Lorraine Hassett, he said he was with Amber Alert and that he needed to finish a DNA file on her daughter. She also said the man asked for her daughter using a name the 13-year-old girl only uses online. Hassett ordered the man off her property and called police, who were later able to catch up with him. Here's the truly odd part. Officers said the man's business was legit. It's just the manner in which the information was relayed that led to some misunderstanding. The involved adult male was passing out child DNA kits, which would be retained by the family in the event it was ever needed for future investigations. You know, it doesn't help your company or organization when you're doing something that benefits the safety and greater good of the community if you're using the creepiest person available as your representative. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Richard Louv is a journalist, author, co-founder of the Children and Nature Network, and winner of the Audubon Medal. His landmark book, Last Child in the Woods, inspired an international movement to connect children and nature and has now sold over 500,000 copies. His newest book is Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Richard redefines the future of human-animal coexistence by exploring our deep bonds with other animals and calling for a transformation in how we view, treat, and inhabit our environment. He joins us on the line from San Diego. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Appreciate you being on the show. Let's talk about the subtitle of your book. And that's my first question. How connecting with animals can transform our lives and save theirs. What do you mean by that?
I mean that if we're aware, if we pay attention, not only to our pets, which I also write about in the book, but to wild animals, they can reduce our stress. In some occasions, they can particularly make us feel more alive. And they can make us aware of a conversation, essentially, that's going on all around us in many languages, of many species. And by doing that, we can reduce our loneliness. There's an epidemic of human loneliness going on that medical folks are now saying is more of a cause for disease and early death than obesity. This has just happened where it's just crossed that threshold. Many people blame that on Facebook and anti-social media and so forth, but I think it's rooted in something even deeper, which is species loneliness, or disconnection from the life around us.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the fact that, you know, there's social media, there's Facebook. People are connecting more online but not connecting in person. If you feel that we're having difficulty connecting one-on-one with each other, how can we then think of connecting with animals? We're not connecting with people.
Well, oddly enough, by connecting with animals, we can find our way back to people. This isn't true of everybody, but this is one of the things I write about in the book. There's a guy out in the Bay Area who is teaching people bird language. He takes them out into the woods, and he teaches them the patterns, not only the tweets and the sounds and all of that, but the patterns that birds have, how they interact with other animals, how other animals interact with them. And in learning bird language, he says, people go home and they come back and they report to John Young, that they're getting along better with their wife or their husband. And John says, you're probably actually listening to them. You're paying attention. And this is really another form of mindfulness. And we can teach ourselves that by, in fact, paying attention to other animals. It's also plants, but this book focuses on animals.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the step toward appreciating animals more, isn't the first step just really respecting the animals and their environment? And the reason why I bring that up is people love their pets. They love their dogs. They love their cats. But sometimes we don't necessarily respect the habitats that animals beyond pets experience. Is that part of the problem? We sometimes take animals outside of our usual realm for granted?
No, that's absolutely true. And as a result of that, there's a recent study that shows that just since 1970, just 50 years, almost 30% of wild birds in North America have disappeared, almost 3 billion birds. There's a lot of reasons for that, but the main reason is habitat destruction. So we're not respecting their habitat. We're not preserving. But I make the case in our wild calling that there are two habitats. There's the physical habitat that, yes, we have to protect. We have to do everything we can to protect the wild areas. But then there's this second environment that I call the habitat of the heart. And that's the connection we have with all the animals around us, recognizing them, connecting with them, listening to them, watching them. If we don't do that, if we don't pay attention to the habitat of the heart, then the other habitat will slowly be destroyed, as will our species. All species are endangered right now. In the short run, we can improve our mental health, our sense of being alive, all of that by paying attention to what I call the habitat of the heart with other animals. In the long run, we can protect the existence of our species and all of the other species.
You've mentioned we a lot, so I guess we're talking about society as a whole, but let's talk about the individual. Earlier, you mentioned the idea that some people might not be into what you're discussing. What do you say to an individual who's not necessarily an animal lover or an animal fan or hasn't been in contact with animals for whatever reason in their past?
Well, one thing is that you're going to have a chance because there's a trend now that more and more wild animals are moving into cities. And there's more wildlife around us in cities than we realize, and it's increasing. And there are a lot of reasons for that. So when we look out our window and see wild animals, we can pay attention to them. We can notice them. We can watch them. Watching birds is fascinating. I mean, that's one of the reasons why bird watching is growing so quickly. We can learn about them. One of the ideas in the book that I suggest is that in neighborhoods, people form something like Neighborhood Watch, but they form Wild Watch groups, which is, you know, our kids and our parents and the retirees at the corner. They begin to watch the animals in their neighborhood, both the domestic animals and the wild animals, and they talk about it. They tell stories about it. This book is filled with stories that people tell about their encounters with wild animals and the meaning they find in those stories. This would do two things to form these groups. One, it would improve our lives. It would reduce our loneliness. It would increase our social contact, in fact, with our neighbors. The other thing it would do is it would protect us and our neighbors from certain wild animals that do carry certain diseases and are overly aggressive because some neighbor has fed that coyote too much. So by forming these groups, I think we become aware of the wildlife around us. We protect it and we protect us.
Are you worried or concerned about the familiarity that some people or some animals will have with people? And I'm talking about wild animals now, because there is some concern that, you know, for instance, if wild animals come into your neighborhood and you start to feed them, then they lose the fear of adults or people and can pose a danger to the community. Are you worried about that or are you concerned about that in any way?
I'm certainly concerned about it. I never say in any of my books that go back to The Last Child in the Woods, which talk about nature deficit disorder, I never say that nature is entirely safe. We do need to avoid feeding wild animals. We do need to inform our neighbors who are doing that, not to do that. It's not good for the wild animals, and it's not good for us. And there are other things. One of the things that happens when wild animals move into cities is their behavior tends to change. oddly enough, they tend to become gentler unless, as you say, they've been overfed. They also tend to become nocturnal. If they're day animals, they become night animals often. So we don't see them as much as we might otherwise, and they don't interact with us as much as they other. And with some animals, that's a good thing. They change us, we change them. In the book, I call that co-becoming. It's kind of like co-evolution, but we co-become, just as we do with our pets. And the book is not only about wild animals, it's also about our companion animals as well.
Well, it's interesting because what you just said about wild animals becoming accustomed to adults and our people and becoming more tame, some people, as I said earlier, might think there's a danger in that, in them becoming more acclimatized to human beings. Is there not a danger to the animal as well? Because if they become more tame, more calm, they themselves become more prey to whatever their predator is in their natural environment.
Well, it's not so much that they become more tame. Some of them do. Occasionally individuals do. It's, in fact, they become more cautious, and that makes them, in some sense, gentler around us. They're less likely to challenge us, for instance, because they're trying to hide. That's one of the ironies of the movement of animals into cities. So it's a lot more complex than it might sound, and it's one of the reasons why exploring this in our families and with other people is so interesting. And my experience in writing this book is hundreds of people have told me their stories of their encounters with wild animals, whether it's in a city or in the wilderness, as well as their relationships with their own companion animals and how they've been transformed by that, how their life has been enriched by that, how they feel more alive because of that.
So bottom line, everybody's life is better with animals in their lives as opposed to separate from their lives.
Yes, with exceptions, because there are exceptions of certain diseases that are carried by wild animals, certain aggressiveness of some species. That's one of the reasons why I think it's important for people to be aware of the wild animals in their neighborhoods, not only to appreciate them, but to protect them and to protect humans from some of them.
One last quick question. Do you think every child should have a pet?
I think there's a lot of evidence that points that way. The science says that having a pet improves the sense of empathy of children. I think it does a lot more than that. I make the argument in the book that my dog, when I was a kid, taught me a set of ethics. And there's a long discussion we could have by that. I wasn't just romanticizing my dog. It turns out that it's possible that not only did we domesticate gray wolves that became dogs, but they domesticated us, our early ancestors, because we followed them as they hunted. We learned about cooperative behavior. We learned about teamwork. We watched their families and how good wolves are to each other in their families. We may well have learned a set of ethics from them and added those ethics to our own. And there are researchers in Germany that have actually used that word ethics.
The book is called Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Thank you very much, Richard, for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Richard Louvre, author of Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0539, and you'll find links to Richard's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to teen actor Marcus Zane. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I got one more Stuff File news story I want to share with you here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also Spotify. A Scottish police officer who punched himself in the face and headbutted a door in a twisted bid to frame his wife for assault avoided jail, but faces being booted out of the force. His plan backfired when a teenager filmed his bizarre ham-acting antics on her mobile phone. The footage shows 40-year-old Sergeant Barry Murphy yelling, "You just hit me! I can't believe you just hit me!" when there was no one close to him at the time. Murphy was given 275 hours of community service and a 5-year non-harassment order after faking fear and crying out, "I'm scared!" as his estranged wife, 35-year-old Cheryl, made a 999 call. Dunfermline Sheriff Court heard the disgraced cop is now looking for work as a cabbie after he was nailed for the outburst. Yeah. His story is in all the newspapers in Scotland, particularly in Edinburgh, where he worked as a cop. He's not going to be getting many tips as a cabbie. That's just my guess. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor Marcus Zane is busy these days. He has a recurring role on Riverdale and will be seen opposite Adam Brody in the upcoming feature film The Kid Detective. Marcus is just one of the latest Canadian actors who are making the leap from Vancouver to Hollywood. He joins us on the line from Vancouver. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
So, awesome. Thank you for having me.
You, as I said, are in Riverdale. You have a recurring role. Riverdale shoots in Vancouver. So how has it been for you working on a show that is so popular? For instance, what is the recognition factor now that you've been on that show?
I mean, it was amazing. The amount of fans that messaged me after the show was awesome.
How has that changed for you? Suddenly, high recognition factor like that.
Well, it's been amazing. I've definitely seen it help me with my acting, building up that resume, and just getting in the next room. It's been really amazing. There was so much positive feedback that came my way. It was awesome.
And as I mentioned, you're also going to be seen opposite Adam Brody in an upcoming feature film called The Kid Detective. Tell us about your role on that.
I'm not allowed to talk about it too much yet, but what I can say about it is that it was my most physical role that I've ever done. It was the first time I've done my own stunts in a show. So that was kind of a new process and definitely something unique about that experience.
You see, normally I would have asked you what you did on Riverdale, but I know in a lot of cases you can't talk about that either.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that stuff's come out, so I can talk about it a little more. It's just because The Kid Detective is still in the process coming out.
Okay, so what can you tell us about your role in Riverdale?
That was amazing. That was such a fun role. It was so cool to meet Cole Sprouse and, Camila Mendes, all of them. That was so cool. I had watched a lot of Zack and Cody growing up. So to see someone I'd looked up to and have the opportunity to be able to work with them was amazing. I really enjoyed it.
So meeting people who you've admired for years, did it make it any more difficult to act against them? Did you get the butterflies out? How did that work out for you?
I was definitely nervous going there, but once you kind of get into it, the nerves go away. I'd say it was definitely a little more challenging working with someone I looked up to, though. Just seeing him on TV as a kid and whatnot, and him being one of the reasons I actually got into it.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you're making the leap from Vancouver to Hollywood. Do you get to go back and forth a lot? And do you see yourself eventually moving to California?
Yeah, I go back and forth quite a bit now just for auditions and whatnot. I'd say, yeah, L.A. is definitely the place I'd want to live permanently. I love the city there. I'll always see Vancouver as my home, though. I really like it here.
What was it that gave you the acting bug? How did it all start for you, and why did you want to do this? And how old are you when you started?
I was 6 when I started. I saw an ad in the newspaper, for to audition for an agent, and that was the first time that I had gone to one. And I'd say just in general, movies have always been a really big thing in my house, and my mom's been super supportive with getting me into classes and stuff when I took interest in it.
What was your first role?
I did a Mario Maker commercial for the Mario Maker video game.
You know, it can be a crushing experience. I mean, you have to audition for roles. There's a lot of rejection. What was it like at a young age when you went for something that you didn't get?
Obviously, there's some instances where there's some disappointment, but I kind of see it as just an opportunity to get better. And at the end of the day, I really enjoy acting, so even auditioning is a fun thing for me. So if I don't get the role at the end of the day, it was still fun for me.
If you were to see yourself in a particular role, in a particular character, what's the ultimate? What would you like to do if you could decide on any role in any show or movie? What's your goal?
That's a good question. Honestly, I can't decide because there's so many things I would love to play. One of the things I want is to have a big range, so just being able to play all sorts of different characters.
Now, you're a teenager, and often teenagers get to play one of two things, either the good kid or the bad kid. Which one do you like?
I think it's more fun to play the bad kid. The good kid's always fun to play, though, too.
With shows like Riverdale, I mean, you had a recurring role in that series. I also understand you did a TV pilot for PBS called Chad. Would you like to have a regular role in an ongoing television series, or would you prefer to have movie roles?
I mean, I'd love to work on anything. So I would say definitely being in a TV show or a movie would be ideal for me. I love being on any type of set and just getting to meet all sorts of new people. So wherever acting takes me, I'm really happy with it.
Now, I mentioned The Kid Detective. You haven't started that yet, correct?
The Kid Detective is wrapped, I believe.
Oh, it is wrapped?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's wrapped. I believe they're just in the editing process right
okay.
now.
Okay, so you as you said earlier, you can't tell us about the story, but can you tell us a little bit about the experience you had on the set? What was that like working with Adam Brody?
It was amazing. You know, he was a really cool guy. Great actor. He was really professional too, and like I said before, that was my first time actually doing my own stunts on set, so he was there with me through that process, and he was really helpful.
So what do you have upcoming next?
Right now I'm just looking forward to Christmas and my break here and getting started in the new year. I'm going down for LA in February, and I'm hoping to get some good roles here.
One of the things that happens in the early part of the year, around May, it's basically pilot season. I mentioned
yeah.
you were also in a pilot for the television series Chad. Are you still looking forward to pilot season in the United States in the beginning of the next year?
I've been looking forward to it for a while now, and I'm super excited to go down there for pilot season.
Well,
it's going to be awesome.
Well, continued success with all you do, Marcus, and thank you very much for taking the time to being on the program with us. Now, you mentioned The Kid Detective is wrapped. Can you tell us when it's coming out, or do you not know that yet?
The release date is not official yet.
Okay. Can you give us a season? Like, will it be in the fall or the spring
Honestly,
of next year?
I'd say fall, yeah.
Okay. So we just have to keep looking for the name Marcus Zane. Marcus, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Actor Marcus Zane. Again, he has a recurring role on Riverdale, and he will be seen sometime next year opposite Adam Brody in the feature film The Kid Detective. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Deputies have charged a Fort Myers, Florida man for impersonating an officer after reports he operated his Bentley car as if he were law enforcement. 30-year-old Christopher Duluck is charged with felony falsely impersonating a law enforcement officer and had his vehicle seized. Deputies received reports that Duluck was operating his 2009 Bentley in a reckless manner, utilizing a police siren and lights to maneuver around traffic and to intimidate others. He also reportedly attempted a traffic stop on a motorist utilizing lights and sirens, but drove off at a high rate of speed when the citizen pulled over. A search of his vehicle revealed a speed measurement device similar to what is commonly used by law enforcement and police-style antennas mounted on the car. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're going to impersonate a police officer, why would you do it in such an ostentatious vehicle like a Bentley? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0539. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0539. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCore in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.